Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. The media are complacent while the world burns. That is the headline of a story jointly published by The Nation's Mark Hertzgard and the Columbia Journalism Review's Kyle Pope. They report that only 22 of the 50 biggest newspapers in the United States covered last October's explosive UN report warning that humanity has a mere 12 years to radically slash greenhouse gas emissions or face a calamitous future in which hundreds of millions of people worldwide go hungry, go homeless, or worse. A few other facts in the piece: moderators did not ask presidential candidates a single question about climate change during the three primetime general election debates in 2016, in 2012, in 2008, or ever. And also, in an 18-month period, TV and print outlets gave 40 times more coverage to the Kardashians than to the acidification of oceans caused by rising temperatures. So what explains this? Well, they write that of all the reasons for this journalistic failure, the most decisive is also the most nefarious. For decades, ExxonMobil and the rest of the fossil fuel industry deliberately deceived the press and thereby the public. But the fossil industry's lies succeeded only because U.S. news organizations swallowed the industry's propaganda and regurgitated it as supposedly objective news. Joining us to talk about this piece and what it will take to change media coverage of climate change is Kyle Pope, editor-in-chief and publisher of the Columbia Journalism Review. Hi, Kyle. Thank you for joining us.
Hi. Glad to be here.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Rebecca Lieber, a reporter in Mother Jones' D.C. bureau, where she covers environmental politics and policy. Rebecca reports that when it comes to environmental issues, the 2020 presidential election will be much different than past elections. Environmental and progressive groups are calling on the Democratic National Committee, TV networks, and the 2020 candidates to dedicate one of the dozen official debates to the climate crisis. Hi, Rebecca. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Well, thank you both for all of the great work that you do. After the election, we decided to dedicate every Monday to environmental issues. We call it our One Planet series. And we talk about a range of issues, from the fires in California to palm oil plantations in Indonesia. And there's so much out there. I mean, we could do 5 days a week on this. So it's really disconcerting that the broadcast TV networks are not really covering this. Kyle, I mean, the numbers that you write about in your report are pretty dismal. Did you, when you looked at all these numbers overall, did you expect it to be this bad? I mean, I read little bits and pieces over the last couple months, but when you put it all in one story, it's pretty daunting.
Yeah, I mean, I did expect it to be this bad, actually. you know, it's deceptive, because, you know, for a lot of us who cover or who watch media, and, you know, we read what the New York Times is doing and The Guardian is doing and people like Mother Jones and NPR. I mean, there's a lot of great coverage, and there's a lot of great climate change coverage. Unfortunately, those places aren't where most Americans get most of their information. So, you know, we felt it was important to look at what's on local TV and what's on national TV and what's being published in local papers around the country, and you get a whole different story. And it's grim, and it's grim at a time when, you know, the scientific consensus is that we've lost the sort of luxury of time to try to figure this out. So we really thought that we have a platform at CJR that where we are able to talk to a decent chunk of the media world, both in the U.S. and around the world, and at a lot of these smaller mid-sized newsrooms, both print and TV, and we just thought this is a moment that we have to be able to talk to them and talk to them about about the coverage decisions, about, you know, why they're not doing this or how could they do it better, but also I think just as importantly, talk to them about like how could we think about like better ways to tell this story that resonate with people. Because there is this kind of like circular problem we have right now, which is that a lot of media outlets aren't reporting on climate change because they think it's a story that their readers or viewers don't care about. And I think and one of the reasons their readers and viewers don't care about it is that I don't think they're putting as much creativity and muscle into how they're telling these stories to get it to resonate with people. And you know, our view is that telling stories is what we do as journalists, and like our job is to find a way to tell stories that sink in and that resonate with people. And then if they're not sinking in and they're not resonating, it's not so much the audience's fault as it is our fault. You know, how are we not sort of crafting this, or how are we not finding ways to tell these stories that really are connecting with people? So that's sort of where we're spending a lot of our effort, and you know, we can talk about how we're doing that, but that's sort of how we see the world.
One of the important points you make in the piece is, as you mentioned, The Guardian is doing excellent reporting. As you write in the piece, it's got a team of 9 full-time reporters and editors who focus on the climate crisis. But you point out that it's really important that this information is also discussed and debated, if we talk about the Green New Deal. We're not debating the climate crisis, but it has to be on television because so many people still get their news from television.
Yeah. I mean, we have the opening of the piece that Mark Herzgard and I wrote is about this this piece that Chris Hayes ran on MSNBC that was actually like a really terrific sort of overview of what the problem was, and it was last summer. And he devoted a lot of energy on his show. It was actually in 2016 that this stuff aired. It was at All In with Chris Hayes, and he spent an entire week highlighting the impact of climate change in the U.S. Interviewed a lot of people, sort of really put the whole thing together really well. But then he later tweeted sort of the observation that every time they do climate coverage, it's sort of a ratings killer, which meant that the incentives weren't that great. And people really pounced on him and sort of really criticized him for that observation. And they were like, you know, you guys have to transcend ratings. This is a bigger problem than that. But, I mean, I think we have to be sort of like, I think we have to engage that part of the issue as well. That, you know, it's that there is both a reality and just as important, a perception that this stuff just doesn't resonate. And I think, you know, part of the reason why we as CJR are really getting involved in this is I think we have to get the journalistic community together to talk about, one, how can we craft stories that will resonate, but also, like, what is our responsibility as citizens and as sort of important voices in our communities to do these stories, even if it's going to take a while for them to find an audience? Like, I think that we have, you know, there are some stories that just sort of transcend all these numbers, and we have to get the journalism community to sort of think in a different way about it. I mean, what's really dangerous about the moment that we're in is that the damage to the environment and the sort of like incredibly urgent moment that we're in is happening just as the news industry is probably as weak as it has been in its life. The economics of the news business are terrible, especially at the local level, especially in newspapers at the local level. So we're basically at a moment where we're asking them to sort of like devote significant resources to covering a story that they haven't been covering very well, that takes a lot of creativity, a lot of time, takes some amount of expertise at exactly the time that they're just struggling to sort of keep the lights on and, you know, do the most fundamental basic things that they're supposed to be doing. So it's a sort of like the timing is really bad, but there's not much we can do about that. We just sort of have to deal with what we've got. But that adds another element of complexity to the whole thing.
Rebecca, Mother Jones also does excellent reporting on the climate crisis. You cover environmental politics and policy, and we're going to talk about your reporting throughout the show. But can you talk about the kind of resources that Mother Jones has put into covering the climate crisis, and what do those conversations sound like?
Yeah, I was thinking while Kyle was talking about the challenges facing media on resources and investment in climate coverage, this was actually a problem that outlets like Mother Jones set out to try to do something about. A few years ago, we have something called Climate Desk that is over 16 outlets, national and some more regional outlets, and also a few Canadian ones that partner in sharing content. And the idea behind that is to lift all boats and to invest more resources into covering this, because that's just a reality that there's limited resources to invest in such an important issue. And unfortunately, when we're talking about climate impacts, these are often situations that are far-flung. This is a global issue. Outlets have to devote significant amount just to travel to report and talk to the people on the ground, not to mention disaster that have hit Puerto Rico and Texas and Florida, not to mention around the world. And so Climate Desk is one answer that we've come up with to try to devote more to this topic. I think you see that different answers for over the years, places like the New York Times have devoted a lot more resources just in the last few years to building up its Climate Desk. I think it's hard to know what the chicken or the egg is here, but you also see public interest in climate change going up. And I think devoting more media resources to this is a major part in raising awareness in public interest in this issue and public education.
And also, Mother Jones is launching a new project. Editors Monica Bauerlein and Clara Jeffrey wrote a piece called Corruption Isn't Just Another Scandal, It's the Rot Beneath All of Them, which is directly connected to climate change. So this is going to be a new investigative project called the Corruption Project, and it's a push to do deep, time-sensitive, intensive reporting on corruption as both the cause and the result of the crisis in our democracy. And just one of the examples that they bring up in this piece is looking at the influence of the Koch brothers, looking at the EPA, which is run by a former coal lobbyist. The list is very, very long when you're talking about corruption in this administration. So can you tell us also a little bit about the new Corruption Project and how that's going to connect to the climate crisis?
Right. We're raising money right now. I think this is in getting off the ground stages to devote more to corruption, which has long been a theme for Mother Jones coverage. So the idea is to get more reader participation and support, so we can hire someone devoted particularly to these themes of corruption. But in the meantime, and what we continue to be doing here is focusing on how this threat of corruption carries through the entire Trump administration. I think when you talk about the environment and climate change, that's probably the strongest example where you have coal and oil lobbyists taking over the regulatory agencies. You have direct access for industry in the decision-making process in a way we've never seen before for environmental regulation. And I think with climate coverage, it's sometimes there's different, kind of divisions almost in that some climate coverage is just looking at the impacts, and it's just looking at what we have to do about reducing emissions, and then looking at the greenwashing that's done by corporations and what the big oil companies are saying lately about carbon pricing and climate pollution. These are all the same story. And I think when you're looking at this from the corruption lens, you start to see how the fossil fuel industry, how the unprecedented access in the White House is really connected to these other issues of inaction and the threat before us. So that's a huge theme of our coverage going on. I've been reporting on the EPA and Interior Department in depth the last few years, and that's going to be an even bigger theme going forward.
Rebecca Lieber is a reporter in Mother Jones' D.C. Bureau, where she covers environmental politics and policy. You can find her pieces at yourcallradio.org. Kyle Pope is editor-in-chief and publisher of the Columbia Journalism Review. And I hope you can take the time to read the piece that he co-wrote with the nation's Mark Hertzgaard calls. It's called "The Media Are Complacent While the World Burns." It's a really in-depth, excellent piece about what we are currently facing and really how we got here. If you have any questions or comments for our guests, what are your thoughts about media coverage of the climate crisis? As our guests were saying, there's really good coverage when you look at the independent media. The Guardian has a great team. We had on a New York Times reporter last week. They're doing a lot of interactive coverage. But when you look at the cable shows, it is dismal. The presidential debates have been, there have been no questions asked, but that's definitely going to change this time around. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. I have to say, Kyle, the other thing I appreciated in your piece is that you look at how we got here, and you and Mark write, "For decades, ExxonMobil and the rest of the fossil fuel industry deliberately deceived the press and the public." You write, "The media lost interest in the story, and when they did cover it, they fell victim to fossil fuel industry propaganda. With both scientific literacy and political courage in short supply in too many U.S. newsrooms, the coverage of climate change declined in volume and quality. And as a result, the politicians didn't feel pressured to act, and the emissions kept climbing." So can you talk about what you found in your research when you looked at what happened in the late 80s and the early 90s?
Yeah, I mean, it's so interesting. I mean, one, there were a lot of parallels between this spin that the fossil fuel industry used and the spin that the tobacco industry used to try to, distract people from the dangers of its product. In fact, there were similarities in terms of even the personalities who were involved in both, which I found totally fascinating. And also, the sort of really the sad part of this story is that there was it wasn't predestined that it was going to go this way. In fact, there was a brief moment where it seemed like where it seemed like the sort of establishment in Washington was appreciated the scope of the problem. Appreciated the scale of the problem and was sort of committed to doing something about it. It lasted for about 10 and a half seconds, but it was there. There's a famous quote of, I think it's George H.W. Bush talking about sort of matching the greenhouse effect with a White House effect, sort of like really, taking this on as a sort of important issue. And then it just sort of got away and it became sort of victim to this spin machine. And you really do have to fault, mainstream media in the U.S. for sort of like not seeing this and falling victim to it. Again, there were places like Mother Jones and The Nation and other places that were on it and continued to write about it and sort of saw it for what it was. There was even some great reporting that came out of Columbia Journalism School, which is where I'm based, that looked at the connections between Exxon Mobil and disinformation around this stuff. But for the most part, it wasn't covered. And then what happened is sort of like this great sort of inertia set in and, frankly, laziness on the part of a lot of news organizations. And then And then this sort of business model crisis hit in the news business, where it became harder and harder for them to tackle these big topics. They became the business model shifted away from sort of big print advertising to digital audiences, and newsrooms started orienting their coverage towards stuff that was trending on social media and that was more likely to get clicks. And it just sort of, again, it's like, it's really a tragedy when you look back at how many, all the bad things that had to happen and line up for this to end up the way it did. And it all sort of conspired against aggressive media coverage of this, what was happening, and a kind of like open-minded attempt to really engage their audience on, like, this is real, this is happening, what these other guys are saying is BS and we can just discount it, but right now we need to focus on what can we do to fix it, what kind of policies do we need to change it. That discussion, for all these reasons that we just talked about, was just derailed, and we lost so many years of a really critical time that where we had to fix it. And now we're I agree with Rebecca that you are starting to see sort of real public interest in this, and you are starting to see sort of, and that I hope will translate into audiences for media around this stuff. And we are in a different moment right now because of what's going on, with this current presidential race and some of the policies that are now sort of in the air that the Democratic candidates are sort of starting to pay attention to. But yeah, it's gonna take. What I'm disappointed is that, I'm still not seeing that translate into a lot of new approaches to the coverage, and I'm a little dubious. I mean, if you look at sort of the Green New Deal coverage, which is a lot of what we're really talking about in terms of how is this going to be different in 2020 or 2019, a lot of the coverage is about it's about the horse race politics of it. It's about what is the chance that this is going to work. It's about like who were the people who were sort of leading it, and what is their personality like, and how are they getting media attention. And there hasn't been nearly enough sort of, for my mind, nearly enough delving into like what exactly are these policies, and how, what is this about in terms of like not only reshaping the way we think about the environment, but reshaping the way we think about our economy. And these are serious proposals that are taking a serious whack at this problem. And I think the coverage is still a sort of partisan politics, even in terms of the way news organizations are looking at it.
Right. And we're going to talk more about coverage of the Green New Deal right after a break. That is Kyle Pope, editor-in-chief and publisher of the Columbia Journalism Review. He co-wrote the piece, "The Media Are Complacent While the World Burns." We're also joined by Rebecca Lieber, a reporter in Mother Jones' D.C. bureau, where she covers environmental politics and policy. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are talking about media coverage of the climate crisis. Kyle Pope is editor-in-chief and publisher of the Columbia Journalism Review. He co-wrote the piece, "The Media Are Complacent While the World Burns." And Rebecca Lieber is a reporter in Mother Jones' D.C. Bureau, where she covers environmental politics and policy. Rebecca, we're going to get to calls in a minute, but I also would love to get your take on just how we got to this point. I think it's always so important to give context and a little bit of history. And as Kyle and Mark point out in their piece, the fossil fuel industry's lies succeeded because news organizations swallowed their propaganda. And they write, the result was to mislead the people and their elected representatives about the perils of climate change and to blunt any sense of urgency. And in Bill McKibben's new book, Falter, he says it's the most consequential cover-up in human history. What are your thoughts about just how we got here in the media?
It's such a long story, and honestly, for people who've even been following this much longer than me, it can feel really repetitive and cyclical, because where we are with the Green New Deal, we've been here before with possible legislation and divisive rhetoric, and often in a really confusing landscape. We have right now parts of the oil industry getting behind a carbon price, but what does that mean really? So how did we get here? For decades now, the fossil fuel industry especially has taken a lead in, at times, outright fostering climate denial, but in other cases, sometimes adopting a more sympathetic position, saying, look, we care about climate. We are going to make some investments here. We are not opposed to something like a carbon tax, but then we don't see that translate into strong policy. And that's often, there's a muddying the waters campaign involved. Just this week, we've seen new documents come out about the Global Climate Coalition, which was an industry-led coalition formed around when the Kyoto Protocol was a possibility. So we have seen a lot of these debates happen before. Over time, for many of the reasons Kyle has outlined, media interest, media coverage will really just go, it can hit a high point, and it did around the 2006 Inconvenient Truth debut and the entry of the Obama administration. But then after the cap and trade bill's death in 2010, media interest just plummeted in climate. And what we saw with Trump coming in is more media coverage of environmental issues and climate. But I wrote a piece last year looking at how the problem with that is Trump is still really driving the conversation. People tend to write stories in reaction to his climate denial rather than tell news stories about impacts of climate change.
Well, we have a number of callers on the line, so let's hear first from Lisa in Oakland. Hi, Lisa. Welcome to the show.
Hi, this is actually Greg from Palo Alto.
Oh, hi, Greg.
Hi. I just want to say, thank you guys for your work. I actually recently started a nonprofit called Science Tomorrow, and I try to always link people to these great articles, which I definitely will do, and especially all the work that Rose does as well. Thank you very much. But I was at the San Francisco Earth Day event this past weekend, and, passed out a lot of cards, and people were able to plant redwood trees and, donate them to the forest, and, it was a really great event. But the reality is I got zero calls or emails in the past week from people, that said they were going to do this or that or help or volunteer or whatever. And I think there is just a lot of apathy, and it's just even more concerning than climate change. It's just the apathy that I see in the public. And, people aren't on fire about this. They're not going to elect officials to do something about it and spend money on it. So, I really am trying to wrap my mind around what's going to take this, current society to really get active. And I think the only way to do that is through news. So I would really love to, talk about doing like a group that can just raise funds just for reporting for climate change to combat some of that, all the money that was spent to, by the oil industry to deregulate, you know, information.
Well, thank you for calling in, Greg. Rebecca, do you want to take that one first? You wrote a piece about Earth Day. It's called "I'm an Environmental Journalist and I Hate Earth Day."
Yeah, maybe provocative headline, but Earth Day. I think, and I hear this a lot from pretty much anyone who's very involved on environmental issues already, that it's frustrating to see it treated as this special day of the year or some other issue. That's my number one pet peeve on all climate coverage, is just treating this as a niche issue when it's really an everything issue. It affects everything from immigration to the economy to healthcare. And Earth Day, I think, plays into this idea of we can try to recycle, we can go green, which is in often a greenwashing campaign and co-opted by the very corporations that have the biggest impact on the environment. Earth Day has become this flood of pitches from the companies that have a huge footprint saying, look at the small step we took. So if you work on this issue, if you are a journalist covering these issues, the things that matter are unfortunately not just putting your water bottle in the recycling bin, but who's elected, the policies that are put in place both locally and nationally. I think the things that end up really mattering the most, they don't take place on a single day of the year. They are they happen during an election cycle. It's how this Green New Deal debate goes. It's the activism and the teenagers who are now taking to the streets and going on strikes, who are making sure this is an issue that's in people's face all days of the year. So Earth Day, I think, reflects a bit more of a traditional sense of environmentalism on this more individual scale. And that was the sense behind why I declared I hated Earth Day.
Mm-hmm. Well, did you see much coverage of Extinction Rebellion around Earth Day? This is a group in London. It started there, but it's really going around the globe. And I only heard coverage of this on Democracy Now! In fact, just this morning, they reported that there have been 1,100 arrests after 10 days of climate civil disobedience in London. But I have not heard those numbers in the U.S. media. Rebecca, have you been covering this or have you been following this?
You know, I agree. I think the U.S. coverage on this has been abysmal, and for many of the reasons we were talking about a little bit earlier. I think one of our climate desk partners, The Guardian, they're based in the UK. They've been doing a great job keeping on top of this and covering the Extinction Rebellion. I like to look at things sometimes from where the future of activism is going and where we are now. And it's certainly an interesting moment. And I think we're seeing we're just seeing new moments for climate protests to really break through. And we saw that with Sunrise Movement and the Green New Deal and the school strikes, and now Extinction Rebellion, of how this really ends up driving a news cycle. And I think, unfortunately, at times the media is very late to that story. And I think it took many months, for example, for media globally, but especially in the U.S., to take notice of these school strikes that have already been taking place for months. And unfortunately, many outlets can be late to the game on this. But I don't think that has deterred the activism. You've seen just as much. It's been growing. And I think that's another sign of the global interest rising in this issue.
And Kyle, what do you think of coverage of these movements? I mean, when you've got 1,100 arrests over the course of 10 days, that should be a major headline.
Yeah, no, it's so interesting that you bring that up. I was just corresponding with somebody who writes for CJR who's based in London and talking to him about this very issue. Like, and it's, you know, it's gotten a fair amount of coverage. It's gotten more coverage there, but it is crazy how it's just not on the radar at all here. I mean, we don't even have to say it, but I mean, if you compared the coverage of this to the sort of coming royal baby, I mean, it's absurd. And there's big numbers of people involved in this thing. So it is very, very odd to me, actually. I mean, I just want to pick up on one other thing that Rebecca was saying, which I thought was really spot on about the sort of like siloing of climate coverage. Like, we're going to have our sort of special day of coverage. I mean, because the Earth Day phenomenon, which she was talking about, has, how it's sort of been taken over by sort of corporate PR, and I one of the things I think we need to get away from in terms of the media side of it is like covering climate change as if it's kind of its own little special enclosed problem. I think one of the things, and I think that mentality exists in a lot of newsrooms, and it's why a lot isn't being done, because they think, oh, well, we don't have the resources to add like a climate desk. I mean, we're just trying to get City Hall covered. And one of the things that, you know, one of the ideas I think, you know, we actually had in the piece that you mentioned, but also that when we talk to people, try to get them to think about, is like, don't think about it as a climate desk. Just think about climate change coverage being on all your desks. So the crime, the courts, schools, the business desk. And one of the sort of cool things I think we've seen on the media landscape is climate coverage being integrated into a lot of the weather reporting, which is something that is actually happening, where you have there's a growing number of like weather people at local TV stations that are talking about climate change when they're doing the weather, in a very relatable way. So that's an example of like, you don't have to have a sort of standalone climate desk. You can just sort of start integrating climate coverage into everything that you do.
Kyle Pope is editor-in-chief and publisher of the Columbia Journalism Review. Rebecca Lieber is a reporter in Mother Jones, D.C. Bureau, where she covers environmental politics and policy. And on today's Media Roundtable, we are talking about media coverage of the climate crisis. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. There are a lot of damning facts in the piece that Kyle wrote with Mark Hertzgard of The Nation about the lack of coverage on television. And then it's kind of amazing to learn that 22 of the 50 largest papers in the U.S., only 22 covered the UN report last October that says we've got 12 years to radically slash greenhouse gas emissions. And so we're talking about what it will take to actually change this. And then we will also talk about CJR and The Nation collaborating to expand coverage of climate change. Let's go to another caller. Let's hear from Lisa in Oakland. Hi, Lisa. Are you there?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Hi. Yes. Okay. Go ahead.
So what I wanted to talk about was it was an excellent article in Vox about tactical framing that the media uses. They have an article about why you still don't understand the Green New Deal. And it talks about how the way the media has covered the Green New Deal is from this point of strategy and polling rather than the policy substantive benefits. And they talked about a book called The Spiral of Cynicism that Kathleen Hall Jamieson, who's a well-known communication expert, talked about how tactical framing in news coverage actually increases audiences' cynicism, making it more likely that audiences will believe politicians won't keep their promises or they're only acting out of their own self-interest. And they went through and showed how on the Green New Deal, as a result, audience don't know anything about what the substance is, and all they're told is who's going to be behind this, is this going to be accepted in the party, what division is this going to create in the Democrats. So it's constantly just looking at the what they're calling tactical framing, the political viability of a policy proposal, instead of the actual fixation on the strategy, that instead of the actual substance. And I think it's really important that you all are actually focusing on the media, because I do think the media has been complicit in, especially the mainstream cable and TV has been complicit in making people not understand climate change. And I think if people did understand climate change, even though they may tune it out occasionally, I think it also depends how it's covered, they, you know, it's no accident that people in this country, only, 72% of them believe in climate change, whereas more believed in climate change 20 years ago.
Right. Well, thank you, Lisa. I'm glad you brought that up. Rebecca, in the piece you wrote about climate activists targeting the DNC and debates, you point out that the vision for the Green New Deal, when it's stripped of partisan context, it polls at very high rates across partisan lines.
Yeah, the idea of investment in infrastructure and new jobs is hugely popular, and that's really the idea behind the Green New Deal. There's certainly a lot of debate about some of the newer ideas behind this, like a jobs guarantee, but there's fundamental support, and that's there's echoes of that in what the Obama administration did with the stimulus package. But it's so easy when you just ask a politician, because it the idea is about jobs, to say, give me a yes or no, do you support the Green New Deal? What we've seen is the entire Democratic field is willing to say yes, or yes with some qualifications. But that's essentially meaningless, because what reporters really should be getting at is trying to get politicians to define what the Green New Deal would mean in their administration. What does this look like? Is this a ambitious infrastructure package, or is it some combination of executive action through the EPA, some kind of new version of the Clean Power Plan, along with maybe, I don't know, a more modest scaling of this investment, and where this fits in their priorities when they come in? And I think these are the questions that tend to get simplified into give me a yes or no answer. And one thing that came up again and again in this story I did on getting a entire debate devoted on climate change is there's this possibility that I'm think is very likely to happen in the Democratic debates, where you have debate moderators asking pretty simple questions about climate change that we've seen before, like, do you think this is important? Do you believe in the science? Do you support a Green New Deal? And in those situations, candidates all only have to draw a contrast with Trump, which is quite a wide gulf. So it's easy to do, but it doesn't get at what those actual policies are. And that's what the caller was, I think, referencing in the different types of coverage on the Green New Deal. And I think it's a distinction that's so important to make clear as we head into these debates.
And is there any way that our listeners can put pressure on the DNC to ensure that substantive questions are asked about climate change during the debates?
Well, I would direct them, at least, well, after reading my story at Mother Jones, I highlighted a campaign by a number of environmental and progressive groups. They are driving petitions right now. So those are groups like 350, Greenpeace, Friends of the Earth that are targeting a campaign around the DNC. But you're also seeing the youth climate mobilization. They have launched their own petition. And we might see, and we have already started to see, individual candidates calling for a debate. So we have Jay Inslee, who is certainly a long shot in the Democratic field, but he centered his campaign around climate, and he has also called on the DNC to have a climate debate, and has been pushing on his end. So there are quite a few people working on this. I think, without a doubt, we will see more focus in the debates on climate than we did when there were no questions in the 2016 general election, and maybe a few pretty simplistic ones in the primaries. We will certainly see more, but I think it's the quality of the debate that matters as much, and the idea of really digging in for the 90 minutes on questions like fracking and nuclear energy and what a Green New Deal looks like. I think the idea behind a targeted debate, which could happen in Miami, that's where the first debate will be, that's what these green groups are asking for.
Well, and there's a lot of questions to ask about what's happening in Miami in terms of sea level rise. I want to ask you, Kyle, Elisa brought up the piece at Vox, Why You Still Don't Understand the Green New Deal, Tactical Framing is Turning Us All into Cynics. This was by Carlos Maza. And you referenced this piece in your CJR story about media coverage. And in the Vox piece, there's a clip, I'm guessing, because it's a video, of Chuck Todd asking Tom Perez, the chair of the DNC, quote, "Are you concerned the perception of the Democratic Party is going to move too far to the left?" End quote. So this is the frame that now people like Chuck Todd are using for a wide range of issues, from the Green New Deal to Medicare for All to, you know, low or no college tuition, higher minimum wage. And as you point out in your story, all of these policies are very popular with the people. I mean, if you look at the Green New Deal, for example, according to Yale climate pollsters, 81% of registered voters say that they overwhelmingly support a Green New Deal.
Yeah. I mean, what we're talking about is a problem that transcends this, you know, that transcends climate coverage, and it really does infect coverage in general, especially in Washington. And mm-hmm. this really became so evident during the 2016 presidential race, where you had you had many more stories about polling, about the horse race of the campaign, about what were various political consultants advising about different strategies, about, you know, what was Hillary's social media strategy versus Trump's, and all of that coverage swamped the policy discussion. So you had many more stories. We actually did an analysis of scraping stories from the Washington Post and the New York Times, just those two places, and sort of quantified how much of the coverage was all that stuff and how much of this coverage was actually about the ideas that these candidates had. Now, and then you can get into a whole other discussion about, like, equating the policy ideas of somebody like Hillary Clinton versus Donald Trump, one having a sort of a very long and rich history of public service and the other not, but there was an effort to sort of equate the two of them. So, I mean, this is a problem that infects so much of the coverage of American politics, and I think it had a really detrimental effect in 2016. There's not a lot of signs that things are improving as we head into the 2020 campaign, but you can see the exact same thing playing out when it comes to climate coverage.
So on a more positive note, to talk about the good coverage that's out there, CJR and The Nation are collaborating to expand coverage of climate change. Just quickly, what are your plans on that? And are you going to collaborate with local reporters? Because, you know, local newspapers have such an important role to play when it comes to the climate crisis.
Yeah, so we're going to kick this off next week at an event at the Columbia Journalism School that we're hosting with The Nation. And a lot of the people that we've been talking about, Carlos Maza, who's the writer who did the Vox piece and video, Bill McKibben, who just has this amazing book that's just out, Alexandria Villaseñor, who's one of the organizers of the student strikes, as well as a bunch of journalists. We're getting them all together in a room to sort of and Mark Hertzgard, my co-writer on this piece, to talk about, one, you know, go through a little bit of the history about how we got here, about why the coverage is what it is, but then very quickly turn to, like, okay, what can we do about it? How can we help newsrooms think through their climate coverage? How can we help them sort of, I mean, one of the things that CJR can do is serve just as a repository for great coverage. So if you're a smallish newspaper somewhere and you want to see how other small newspapers cover climate change or the effects of climate change in their communities, we can be a place where we can sort of, you can sort of come to us and you can see what other people are doing. We can also help connect reporters with activists, with scientists, to help sort of bridge, again, help people break out of these silos. So we're having this event on Tuesday, and then we're going to be working over the next several months through white papers and through Skype calls and actually through visiting newsrooms, especially at the local level. We're also teamed up with The Guardian as well as with the NPR affiliate in New York, WNYC, who is going to help us in connecting us with NPR stations around the country. And we all want this to culminate in a single day in the fall. We'll announce that actual day soon, but we're going to try to get as many newsrooms in the country on that day to commit significant coverage on the effects of climate change in their communities. So we're kicking it off today. Oh, Bill Moyers is also involved in this, who's been a big sort of supporter of all this effort. So we'll be doing the thing this next week, but then you'll see over the next several months we'll be really working with newsrooms around the country.
Well, great. We'd love to learn more about that as it takes off. We have an email from Ruby. She writes, as I'm listening, I'm thinking of the excellent series that has run the past week or so on the Antarctic on the PBS NewsHour. It's a very clear picture of what's happening to the planet. Imagine our travel canceled to exotic locations because the icebergs are breaking apart and the penguins are at risk. No more Galapagos, no more Machu Picchu. Read National Geographic instead. I mean, it's a great point. This is a really amazing series that's airing every Wednesday on the PBS NewsHour. On Monday, we had Ron Naveen, a penguin scientist, on our show. He was featured in that documentary. Rebecca, have you seen that PBS piece, those pieces?
You know what? Yeah, I haven't, but I've noticed, I think I've seen so many more documentaries lately devoted to climate and like a combination of these, the nature docs and covering climate impacts. And I know Netflix recently had one out. I've seen National Geographic do more and PBS. So definitely, I think that's a great outlet for it. And honestly, like we were talking about earlier, the visuals and TV coverage has so much potential for reaching people and bringing this home in a way that makes it here and now. And shows you how it actually affects things you care about. This isn't just a hypothetical. So that's great that it's PBS is reaching new out in that way.
Rebecca Lieber is a reporter in Mother Jones' D.C. Bureau, and Kyle Pope is editor-in-chief and publisher of the Columbia Journalism Review. Thank you both so much for joining us, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.